Today's program has been brought to you by Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie. Discover the best artisanal foods that America has to offer. Shop for more at manykitchens.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, right about this time, we engage in a conversation about a topic that I think is incredibly important and not often spoken about, especially in the world of food, ironically, and that is the topic of taste. And today we're really excited to have with us in the studio someone who has done a lot of thinking about taste in his long career, in his short life, as chef and owner today of Empolan Cocina and Empolan Taqueria, but also in some of his incredible work in some of the great kitchens of restaurants of a different sort, and we'll talk about that at Clio and at Alinea and at WD50 here. It's my pleasure to welcome to the studio Alex Stupak. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So there are so many things I think we could talk about, given your career and your experience and your current restaurants that have to do specifically with taste. And one of them, I want to just start with a broad question to you. And when you think about food, when you think about the food you're making, whether you're in your restaurants or just out eating, like, how do you approach creativity as it relates to taste?
We try to do two things simultaneously with all of our dishes. This ties into kind of my background in working in modernist kitchens. There's great modernist food, just like there's bad modernist food, just like there's great Italian or bad Italian.
Of course.
And one of the things that this never happened at the two restaurants that I really liken to that, WD50 and Alinea, but you'd hear a lot of chefs say, well, the customer just doesn't get it. They don't get it. It's over their head. And I've always thought that was a real cop-out.
Right.
I think a perfect dish would be one that when you take a little taste of it, you're compelled to devour it voraciously.
Right. Even if you don't get it, maybe.
Yeah.
Right.
But then on top of that, if you're a person who's interested in technique or, well, hey, how did they do that? Or what did they think of that? How did they think of that flavor combination? It made you think about that too. If a dish can do both of those things, those are our filters of what we're trying to do.
Okay.
Honestly, like still with our menus, sometimes we still fail at that, but that's what we kind of look at our menu items as like line items of like what we have to start working on next.
Oh, interesting. So you perhaps surprised people at Alinea at WD50, you were a pastry chef, and mm-hmm. then you opened, I'm using air quotes here, Mexican restaurants.
Right.
And not a bakery and not a dessert bar, which was happening, you know, at a certain trend. And so I'm wondering what that trajectory in your mind and in your cooking process was for you and how you came to that decision to open what some would say unexpected, but,
right.
but obviously was a very considered decision.
My logic is it does exist, but
sure.
I've been told that it's counterintuitive and often flawed.
like all good logic, let's say.
Maybe. I mean, to start, I became a pastry chef for weird reasons. I became a pastry chef because I was a sous chef and I kind of wanted to be left alone. I was young and I, for whatever reason, it was really, really important to me to have my name on a menu mm-hmm. and to be getting credit for ideas. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was obsessed with, I mean, I still am, but I was obsessed with Albert Adria at El Bulli. Mm-hmm. And my first pastry chef job was me tucked away in a basement, kind of making every recipe out of his first book for about 4 years.
Wow.
That's how I got started. And, I wasn't necessarily always married to pastry,
right.
or wasn't always affiliated with it. It just so happened that first pastry chef job at Clio turned into another really great pastry chef job at Alinea, and then turned into another really great one at WD50. Uh-huh. But
so let me just stop you there. But besides the ability to put yourself out there and sort of assert your own perspective on pastry or whatever you were doing. What was it about Adria that resonated with you? Why his recipes? Why him?
Because he in his work, he kind of explains, he kind of moves through flavor and really does it by way of technique. Mm. And it was really fascinating to me just to start to break everything down where it's like, well, if I want to transmit the flavor of passion fruit and vanilla, okay, great. But what, like, how is the passion fruit going to manifest and how is the vanilla going to manifest? Is it, you know, a passion fruit custard with a vanilla ice cream, or is the vanilla sorbet, or is it an ice, or is it? And I really liked the sort of technical grid or sandbox that he was building and kind of ever widening for mm-hmm. himself. And I think that was really the birth of what had become modernist cooking. Like, for me, like, it seems like it's a relative term, and it means different things to different
right.
people.
Right.
But I like to compare it to the modernist art movement, which for me, again, I'm not an art buff or an expert by any means, but it seems like a lot of that work was really about, almost more about the act of doing it, how you were
the
creating,
approach, uh-huh.
yeah. And I definitely liken that to the work of El Bulli, mm-hmm. and I thought that was really fascinating. It's more about
the process,
yeah. And you remember like all this slew of press. It's like the second hydrocolloids came onto the scene in a big way. It's like you could just simply say the word gel and gum and you would get a sound bite. And
because you might have just done that, I think, here.
Right,
well, gel and gum. I'm going to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So people became very interested in just all these new technologies
right.
and new methods in kitchens. I was in those types of kitchens during that time. Mm-hmm. That this will sound weird, but that's what pushed me to go towards Mexican food. I mean, I love Mexican cooking, and I love that it's kind of, I still think it's misunderstood and it's underappreciated and uh-huh. it's undervalued. So that attracted me to it very much. But then the other part of it was that once something begins to catch on, I immediately get put off by it, or I want to travel away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So if at one point using gel and gum or using xanthan gum or all these things, which are like, I mean, they're staples in our kitchen now. They're just, they just belong there. But if at one point that was, I don't know, like, I don't have a good word, like edgy or rebellious or,
right.
or if
avant-garde.
If it was that at one point and then it's not, well, then what is? And I think a big, big thing that gets labeled, or for me, that was always, I labeled creative, as like the idea of reversalism. If people are going this way, then you should go that way.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's built right side up, you should try to figure out a way to build it upside down. So to that point, if the path for me is really about creativity or trying to do what you don't know how to do, I had to veer off in a major way.
And enter a taqueria.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so why a taqueria, not Peruvian food, cevicheria, or just what about it was compelling to you?
It could have been Peruvian food in another life.
Right.
It just was a matter of what I had been exposed to.
Uh-huh.
I can tell you that my wife Lauren, who was brought up with what I'll call like really good California style Mexican cooking,
uh-huh.
you know, she's one of those people from LA who's a great fish taco is your birthright.
Right.
But when we were planning our wedding, we were planning it in LA, and you know, her mother was taking me to all these really amazing places in East LA, and I started like, you know, having tortillas where it's like, well, I never had one that tasted this good, and
right.
I never had one where it was texturally this satisfying. And it's kind of like the first time you ever go to France and have a baguette, if the only thing you've ever had is a baguette is something in a grocery store,
right.
and in a small town in America, it becomes epiphanal.
Right.
Or it's the same way that like the first time you get to arrive in I'll do air quotes, like a real deal or a fine dining restaurant, and someone hands you a lobe of foie gras and you get to touch that when
right.
you've only ever seen it in cookbooks or on cooking shows when you were a little kid, or a black truffle or something like this. So,
right.
So Mexican food gave me that, it began to give me that feeling all over again. It wasn't really about Mexican culture,
right?
It would be a far more romantic story if my parents were like raised. I was born in Mexico for some reason when I was 4 years old, and I was brought up with the food.
Right,
but that's just not true. It's just epazote or hoja santa leaves or avocado leaves or these interesting Oaxacan techniques, or the list goes on and on. Felt new to me the same way the first time I got to work with Xanthan gum or make a foam, or the first time that I ever got to dust off a black truffle and get to slice it.
So that was daring for a couple of reasons. First, you had a field of ingredients and some sort of tradition to learn or decide to dismiss, but also because we hold, one of the things we talk about on the show often is that we hold ourselves, in New York in particular, but in America in general, as this place where authentic cuisines of all places come together, and you can, you know, maybe there are better French restaurants or Mexican restaurants or whatever in those cultures, but you can get good ones of all of them here and that kind of stuff. And there's this real, I think, badge of honor among New Yorkers, I'll speak specifically, of the authenticity of their food, even though I think mostly it's kind of bogus. You know, it's hard to find an authentic Italian restaurant here, mostly because people wouldn't want them if they were like they were in Italy. But you set out to do this daring thing and open a Mexican restaurant that wasn't intending to be an authentic experience, but just a paradigm, let's say, of flavor and ingredients and dishes. That's pretty daring, especially considering the press here and what people can do to you.
Oh, yeah, it's blood in the water when you do something like that. I still... I'm still kind of in a constant state of fear, and I'm kind of not sure how we're still open, to be perfectly honest with you. But.
Right. But I guess, is there something about choosing a field, let's say, or a playing area to work with that helps inspire creativity rather than just having a completely open canvas?
I think it forces it. If you create, look, at the end of the day, Grant Dackett had a great saying that I heard him say once, which was that by trying to cook outside of the box, all you really do is put yourself inside a smaller box.
Interesting. Right.
In that world of which seems like limitless freedom, there's actually far more filters and rules and stipulations in terms of what can be on a menu in a quote unquote modernist restaurant. It has to be delicious, and it has to be visually arresting, but it also has to do that in sort of a weird way, and it should be a flavor combination that might be unfamiliar, and there should be a technique about it. And it's like, I think that's why, like, in that world right now, you're seeing a lot of reversalism. You're seeing a lot of people say, well, here's a classical French dish from Escoffier, right, on the plate he would serve it on in this setting, what do you think? Just to see if anyone noticed. And I think that's really fascinating.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
I do agree with you, though, in terms of, I think we have everything here in New York, but I think we pass it through a New York filter, or we look at it through a New York lens. I was thinking a lot about Italian restaurants when we were actually planning our first Empe on Taqueria, because I think it's fascinating. This was before my time, and I don't know if this is factual or not, but maybe at one point French cooking where it is today or Italian cooking where it is today in New York City had to struggle quite a bit to get that much range and freedom. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really admirable and fascinating. And I hope that I can be a part of trying to do that with Mexican cooking. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about if you go to a restaurant that, maybe at one point, you could go to a restaurant like La Bernardine or like Danielle or like Jean-Georges, and I think of those as all very unique, author-driven French restaurants. You will get ingredients like yuzu or chilies or lemongrass or all these things that are typically not traditionally in the scope of French cooking. But it just seems normal to me. It just seems natural. But maybe at one point that was actually... maybe that really pissed people off.
I think you mentioned Escoffier. It was as radical then. We often malign the Nouvelle Cuisine movement, but the Nouvelle Cuisine movement, the first person I ever interviewed in the food world was Paul Bocuse, and I was terrified, and I had no idea what to say, and I was surprised when I just asked him how he felt about people perceiving Nouvelle Cuisine, and what he said was the most important thing about Nouvelle Cuisine wasn't anything to do with the food. It was the fact that chefs owned the restaurants and put their name on them, and therefore they could do what they wanted, that they were not bound to the Escoffier Guide Culinaire, which basically codified everything that you were supposed to cook and how it was supposed to be done, and provided something to compare it to, and could, with their name up there themselves, become the authors or the artistes or whatever, for better and for worse, I'm sure. But he didn't think it was the sauce on the bottom or fruit on your plate or no butter in the sauces. For him, it was, as you say, this sort of ability to personally express and pull in all these other things that then became caricatured later.
Yeah, the chef truly taking ownership.
Yeah.
I mean, and arguably without his work, there would have not have been any of us.
Right. And yet we think of already, I mean, because of the however 50, 60 years, you know, he's already become a caricature of French food, you know,
right?
Foie gras soup, with onion soup with truffles and foie gras and a dome of puff pastry is almost solidified right up there with, you know, sauce mornay or whatever that you could think of.
That's a really interesting point because you're talking about something that most of us would just think is quintessentially French, but it's actually an iconic dish for the creative world.
Yeah, and was radical at the time.
Right.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Alex Dupak, who is the chef and owner of Empolon Cocina and Empolon Taqueria here in New York City. And you're listening to Taste Matters.
ManyKitchens.com, you can enjoy decadent caramel brownies, hand-picked teas, and fair trade coffee, oven-roasted chicken pot pies, and so much more. Whether you're planning a dinner party, sending a gift, or just want to try something new and delicious, Many Kitchens offers something for everyone. Help support small batch producers while you discover the best in artisanal foods from across the nation at ManyKitchens.com. Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie.
You are listening to Shadowbox. Let's Not hear our Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Alex Stupak, who's the chef owner of Empolon Cocina, Empolon Taqueria in New York City. And we're talking about authenticity and creativity and taste. I'll remind people listening that if you're listening live, you can call us at the radio station with questions at 718-497-2128. You can also email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or if you prefer to tweet, or maybe you're listening to the podcast, as many of you do, you can tweet us a question or a comment at Taste Matters HRN, and we will retweet it, and we'll try to answer it on the air. So let's talk about the business of running a restaurant. You worked for some of the great restaurants, you know, of our era, and the great chefs. But working for someone is always different than working for yourself and actually running the business.
Way
and
different.
So many people who are creative and talented find it a real challenge, and also in some ways a major limitation. We were talking earlier about having to constantly rejigger for business reasons as well as creative reasons. Talk about the experience, what you've learned in the last couple of years of running your own places.
Well, when I went into our first restaurant, I went in just with a typical chef's mentality of the nothing matters but the food and nothing matters but the kitchen. I honestly was not thinking about it even as if it was my everything in the restaurant was mine. And that was one of my big mistakes, because then a year later, after you get your head straight and you got your kitchen kind of running how you want it to run, and then you start looking around and you're going like, well, why is that in my dining room, or why did we put this there? It just starts to dawn on you, even though it was all being done right before your eyes. So, but then you really can't get mad at anyone other than yourself, because if you don't want to sit in on every meeting, or even better, drive the meetings, if you don't want to take control over every aspect of your restaurant, well, then someone else is going to have to get involved.
Right.
And so then when you start looking at like, okay, well, if I feel really good about my food, well, what other things are people judging it by? Because I think people don't just judge the picture, they judge the frame. So what plate is it sitting on, and what uniforms are your servers wearing, if any, and what music is playing, and at what level, and what's the lighting like, and what's hanging on the walls, and what are the bathrooms doing for you, and all these other things. So that's what, from day one to now, that's what's changed, where I now have chefs who run both my kitchens for me, and I work directly with them, but I also work directly with every other, you know, manager in the restaurant in terms of tweaking or making things better or bringing things more into focus or trying to come up with a reason or an explanation why you even have two restaurants with the same name.
Hmm. And what is that reason or that explanation? And I also, I'm going to extend that question a little bit and be like, in making those other decisions, do they somehow relate to the food and the values of what you're doing on the plate?
I think it's smart if they do. Mm-hmm. I do. I mean, I can tell you that we were at, like, 2013 was very much an inflection year for us where we were kind of questioning, well, why do you have Empeón Taqueria and why is it called that? And why do you have Empeón Cocina? And now we're in the process of saying, well, like maybe, look, they're both Mexican food, but they have to be different. There has to be a different approach or a purpose to the Mexican food in each of these restaurants. And And if you define what that is, it's like I think that everything else in the restaurant should support or reflect or nod to those ideas for some reason. So if at Cocina we're trying to push the boundaries of what can actually even exist on a Mexican menu, maybe you pull all the ethnicity out of it in terms of the plateware or the uniforms. Uh-huh. You just make it as neutral and blank as you can. Whereas maybe in the West Village at Taqueria, maybe we're just trying to explore Mexican flavors that already exist. And maybe to that point, maybe the white china that we have there is all wrong. Maybe it should be rough and textured and feel like something, a piece of something that you would get in Mexico. Those are things that we're constantly looking
trying
at.
Trying to figure out, uh-huh. And it's funny because I was recently, this weekend, there was a panel on Israeli food with a bunch of experts from Israel and around the world. And they were talking about a chef there who has changed. He came from a very high background, and he's opened up a pita sandwich place. And what he has done that is radical there is just stuffed everything in a pita, things that you like a baked potato in a pita with
right.
sauces or whatever. And in some ways, it makes me think of the tortilla, which is a base of a taco, but could hold anything. It just happens to hold the things that they have in Mexico and have been putting in them for a while.
Sure.
And yet, in some ways, it's very hard to go there, just like it's hard to go to Italy and find an interesting perspective on creativity for those foods because the people are so in it. And it, in some ways, I feel like it takes someone from outside to actually add a never considered dimension or an interesting flavor combination that we would be bound from doing otherwise if you had evolved from there.
Well, yeah. I mean, the goal of most cuisines is not to be creative.
Right.
It's to in a steadfast way hold on to tradition. Mexico is an interesting place. I've never been to Italy, but people I've talked to, there seems to be some similarities in that in Mexico, the regions are very borderline clannish in terms of, like, it's not Mexican food. There's really no such thing as Pueblan food, and there's Oaxacan food, and there's food from Veracruz, or there's food from the Yucatan,
right.
And they're all different, and they're not really interested in one another.
Right.
They're very interested in staying separated, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a really interesting thing. I approach the whole thing as an outsider, so I just find interesting things that I'm compelled to reflect or to transmit to New York City, and then that's what I do. And I'm not beholden to my grandmother. She's not going to turn over in her grave
right.
because I bastardized her mole recipe. Because like I can taste every mole in the world and then decide which one I like the best. And even then I could still tweak that recipe
right.
for my own purposes or for the palate of my customers.
It's so interesting because when you think of someone like Rick Bayless, who you know is also not a Mexican person, but who has become a bastion, an authority on Mexican.
I mean, he might as well be a Mexican person.
Right.
He knows a scary amount about that.
Right.
About that
but then there are other. I mean, there's Andy Ricker about Thai food, or even David Thompson, the British guy who's sort of the world expert on Thai food, but they've taken their authority by being these, you know, almost being the codifiers of these traditions, being the outside perspective
right.
that's trying to put it all down before it's lost all that sort of stuff. What's so exciting about what you're doing in some way is saying, no, I'm just here to cook and eat, and I want to see what we
well,
can...
Well, yeah, I think what they do is they do a game, they're playing a game of translation. I think what
right.
ultimately we're trying to do is we're trying to translate it, but then we're trying to also mind map it and say, well, this, as an American, this reminds me of this. An interesting, like very little of what we do in either restaurant is traditional, sure, but by definition, or authentic by definition. I took a trip to Puebla and I had tacos arabes, which means Arab tacos. Uh-huh. And I was fascinated because it's lamb on a pita with salsa and onion, right, and cilantro. And that was, and of course there's a story behind it, and there's influence, or, you know, it has to do with, like most things in Mexico, it has to do with indigenous fusion. But then to that point, My idea is that when does that fusion stop? Like when did we stop?
Right.
When is the book? When do we stop writing the book?
Right. So right.
Mm-hmm. Can you take if you're making a taco in Manhattan, can you take an iconic New York City food like, I don't know, something like gravlax or something like pastrami and put that on a tortilla?
Right.
I mean, because in theory, if New York City had colonized in Mexico 300 years ago, and pastrami was part of, like, maybe that would have happened.
Well, we're sitting here in Roberta's at a great pizzeria. You could just look at a pizza as a tortilla italiana or whatever, that it, you know, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, I think New York. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Please.
I think California, Texas, Arizona, these parts, just due to where they are, they feel like they own Mexican cooking,
right,
and they do actually have their own versions of really great Mexican cooking. I think it's very similar to our views in New York City with Italian food. I feel like, honestly, like I feel like New York City feels as if they own pizza.
Right.
We feel like we own
Italian food.
We own Italian food, and we kind of do, but it's our own version of it. It's right. Our own great version of it. I think that, and I might be a moron for thinking this, but I believe that New York City could have its own great iteration of Mexican food.
Right.
That isn't necessarily traditional, or like, look, it's like exploring tradition and authenticity is very important, but trying to literally replicate a dish, I've always found it to be a futile act. The garlic tastes different there. The cilantro tastes different.
There are people who think it's not just futile, but also in some ways offensive, a form of colonialism that you could sort of take these things from them and translate them into an audience who is not going to be an authentic, quote-unquote, Mexican audience. They're going to be American New Yorkers who can afford and eat in restaurants in the East Village and West Village and do that sort of thing. So there are some even philosophical challenges to that kind of appropriation of authenticity, of authentic foods.
Sure. And I guess I get that, but I don't think I can, or any chef can, let that slow them down. I mean, we're running restaurants. Wherever we're running restaurants, we have our own set of issues that we have to surmount, and we're passionate about something that one way or another we want to share with people.
Sure. And hopefully it's delicious.
Well, it has to be delicious.
It isn't always delicious, but even authentic things. I mean, I'm always on record as saying, just because it's authentic doesn't mean you want to eat it.
Oh, for sure. Like, I mean, like there's plenty of moles that I've had in Mexico or Oaxaca or Puebla where, like, I felt like they had way too much sugar, or like were, for whatever reason, I didn't like them.
Right.
And you start to, that's when you kind of have to start to talk to someone like Rick Bayless, because he'll tell you whether it was prepared right or wrong, and then you have to make a decision. Well, is it, like, even if it's prepared perfectly, maybe I just don't like it.
Right.
Maybe we're not used to that palate.
Right. Which I think is one of the challenges that modernist cooking, to bring it all around, presented to diners, you know, looking, dissecting different pieces, putting them together in different ways, and focusing on elements of things that some people didn't like and some people did. And the whole point of some of the project was to ask yourselves that, to challenge yourselves to that, which I think is an interesting process, as you described.
Sure.
Thank you for being with us. It's a pleasure. It's the first time we've actually talked, but it's not the first time I've enjoyed your food.
And I really appreciate coming, and
really,
thank you.
It's really great. We're always happy to have people who are not just incredibly talented, as so many chefs in New York and around America are these days, but also articulate and contemplative about what they're doing. And so it's really great to have you here. Next week, we are welcoming a totally different type of guest. We are going to be, well, maybe not, I don't even know. But Kevin West, in addition to being a great magazine editor, is a great home preserver and has recently written a book that is charming for so many reasons we're going to learn, called Saving the Season. It is not your normal canning book, but it is full of wonderful and delicious normal canned food recipes. So we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, if you can't find yourself at one of the empalons, the taqueria or the cocina place, maybe you, whatever you're eating, you ought to think about at how it got to be there. I mean, as I always ask you to do, focus on the flavor, but not just the flavor, but you know, what it is that it means and represents, and whether or not there's something that if you were cooking it, you might think could be done differently or more authentically or less authentically as you choose. Because as we always say, taste really does matter. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.